I'm extremely happy to have with us today Professor David Forsythe. He is, of course, as pretty much all of you know, one of the leading experts in computer vision. More than that, he wrote the book, which I'm sure anyone who has taken vision, either from Marcel or Srinivas, has read this book cover to cover.
They love it.
That's not what the Amazon reviews say.
Well, we can we can pat the Amazon reviews. The beauty of collaborative commenting. David has done an amazing number of different things in not just in vision but also in computer graphics. He has a very wide breadth. He has worked on he has one of the basically most cited paper on color constancy. He has one of the most cited papers on character animation motion graphs. He has done lots of work in using large amounts of data to understand faces, so the famous face and names and faces in the newspaper and others of this sort. David has been an expert in understanding humans and human motion and detecting humans, the topic of this talk, and it could go on and on and on. So David has wide interests, and he's from South Africa. He did his PhD or DPhil at Oxford University with Sir Mike Brady, the Knight of the British Empire. the only knight in computer vision.
No. The Gabor Wavelets guy.
Yeah,
retinal.
Mm-hmm.
But
Logan Higgins was never a knight.
No.
And then he was a professor at UC Berkeley for a number of years. My first vision class was with Professor Forsythe. And now he is at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And today he is going to talk about watching all of you guys.
Yes, and I keep... Thank you. I keep getting mixed up about my title. I think watching people is better than looking at people. So I'm going to talk about a bunch of stuff, fairly superficially, done with a lot of people. My student Leslie Okamoto, my sometime colleague James O'Brien, my student Ryan White, my student Anthony LeBay, my ex-student Okan Arakan, another ex-student Deva Ramanan, a current student Ali Fahadi, an ex-student Nazlia Kisler, and another ex-student Wei Yan. So it's a cast of thousands. Why would we care about human motion, sort of at the big level? Why bother? The one answer that everybody will give you in computer vision is surveillance. It's very important. We want to watch people and discover what the bad guys are doing. Are they planning to do this? Are they planning to do that? Are they behaving in a suspicious fashion? But there are other answers which maybe are a little less distressing or possibly creepy. You might have a ton of video that you had collected at a truck stop, and typically if one's trying to spot recreational pharmaceuticals being moved around by a truck, you may only see one or two exchanges every year. So the FBI agent is going to sit down and watch a year of surveillance video. That takes about a year to watch, and it's a bore. What you'd like to be able to do is search it, find the bit where the interesting stuff was happening, and then display that. You can do other things. There are extensive stories about how vision might be useful in HCI, and there's some evidence that those are going to come to fruition. Here's another simple little story, which is rather fun. In architecture, there are a bunch of design rules about public spaces. So you shouldn't put the tree too close to the fountain because the birds will sit in the tree and it's bad for the fountain, etc., etc., etc. Those design rules have been produced by studies of video of people in public spaces, typically marked up by hand, and typically done 20 to 30 years ago because it's a really boring thing to do. We know that the design rules don't often work. So what you might do is just watch people in public, see what they're doing, and see if that tells you anything about architectural design. And some years ago, Wei Yan stuck a camera in a window at UC Berkeley and watched people out in public. He built tracks by the very simple expedient of tracking the back of people's heads. And if you look at them from above, People's heads are a remarkably reliable indicator. They're quite easy to track. You can keep track of the individuals. And you can discover some things that we knew. One of them is that it takes quite a long time for the first person to come and sit down at the fountain. That's the graph of time, the next person, how long it takes. But the second one comes really quickly. It turns out that's well known to architects. Right? It works for roughly the same reason that duck decoys work for hunters. And it's just one of those things. Here's one of those things we also established that we can't explain. So you can see here a plaza. And these little tracks are the tracks of people's heads. So they're off the ground by about somewhere between 5 and 6 feet. So this little dot is a person whose feet are over here. And when you look at this volume of tracks, basically people come in this side and they go out that side, or they come in this side and they go out that side. Some of them come in here and go down there. And there's a slight tendency when they go down these stairs for them to come around here. It turns out if you actually go to the concrete of the stairs and look at it, you can see that just measured in the picture here, there is dirt and wear marks on the concrete that confirm that most of the traffic that goes up and down the stairs, for some reason or another, passes through this patch of concrete. Right? Nobody knows why. It's just one of those things. I'm sorry? No, it seems to me much more likely that there's an error. Right? So in a situation like this, you get to look at the large scale of the thing rather than each separate track. So here what we might do is learn about the design of public spaces and what people do in public from what should seem like very simple observations. It would be very nice to know why that concrete was dirty. So there are other uses of motion, and these are uses of motion that are sort of not computer vision uses, and we tolerate them nonetheless. One of them is in the synthesis of motion. Can we make things look like people for games, for movies, that sort of thing? Another is in biomechanics. People move differently under the impact of certain diseases. I learned today about some association between depression and the way people move. Something that is beginning to become an issue in home healthcare is if you've had a stroke, the physiotherapist will give you a bunch of exercises to do and send you home. And if you don't do your exercises, you won't get better. But it's not easy for somebody to come into the house and check you're doing your exercises. And if you go back to the physiotherapist and she says, are you doing your exercises? You will answer yes, whether that's true or not. So wouldn't it be nice to have a camera in the ceiling that said, well, this one's doing the exercises, but that one isn't? Real simple application, but potentially very powerful. Finally, and something that doesn't get as much press as it should, people are just interesting. So if you look at most frames of most movies, most pictures in the news, those pictures almost always have people in them. It's mainly about what people are doing. We collected 500,000 news pictures, and I think we ever got a picture of an elephant. So what are the core problems? One of them is we don't really know what needs to be known. In the sense that, this is sort of a Rumsfeld comment, but it's got some merit to it. What do we need to extract from video to accomplish particular tasks? We know how to track certain things, but we don't really know a mapping between the tasks we'd like to execute and what we can actually do. Other very important technical problems. People are very hard to find for two reasons. One is they change appearance by changing clothing, by being bigger or smaller or heavier or whatever, and they change aspect. Bits and pieces can move around, they get in the way of the other bits and pieces, and as a result, the person looks different. A second very important problem is it's extremely hard to track people in detail. Why? Rather loosely, people have small parts that move fast and sometimes rather unpredictably. Small means they're hard to find. Fast and unpredictable motion means in the next frame, you may not find it where you thought it would be based on the previous frame. And finally, we don't really know how to describe what people are doing. So behavior composers. We know that we can walk as well as scratch our heads. We can walk and wave. We can run and then jump. There are all sorts of compositional aspects to behavior. It seems to compose in very complex ways. And worse, we don't have a natural canonical vocabulary of behavior. I can't say, I want to build an activity classifier. Here are the 57 different human activities. Let me now try and rack up a bunch of features and go. There isn't a taxonomy to classify into. So today what I'm going to do is there's a lot of stuff here, and we'll cover lots of it sort of fairly superficially. But the core outline is I want to talk a bit about properties of human motion, and I'll illustrate them by examples from our animation. Some of them will probably be fairly familiar. So this is motion composing across time and across the body. That motion can be surprisingly easy to annotate, but it's very hard to tell the difference between good and bad motion for reasons that are quite difficult to explain. Well, it might be easy to explain, but I don't know what they are. And motion clusters well, which I think is an important point. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about transducing motion. We've got somebody moving around. What can we say about their body? And I'll show examples that suggest you can, in fact, track people. It's hard but feasible. And that once you've tracked them, you can make some progress towards reasoning about where their body is in 3D. And then finally, I'll show different ways of describing activities using this underlying machinery. So animation, we've got a little animated figure, he's running around. So what are the big points? Motion composes, can be easy to annotate, it clusters well. So how do we do motion synthesis? In the old days, you paid somebody and they did the drawings. And that's expensive, it's a really good way to do animation, but it's expensive. Now they might do the Maya instead of doing the drawings, but it's still very difficult. What I could also do is take observations of people moving and bolt them together. There's an old tradition of doing this that got resurrected about 5 years ago now in a variety of very interesting forms. I could use physical methods. So I could say, well, the body is a system of joints. There are force-generating objects. There are masses. There are inertias. We know something about what is... what the forces and torques are. We know something about the inertias. Stick this collection of physics together, run it through an integrator, and see what it does. I could use biomechanical models. I could sort of emphasize how momentum is transferred in a motion, the structure of the planning. Or I could use statistical models. There's a big tradition of these models. So far, they haven't really produced what one would hope for from statistics, but that will probably come. So here's an idea that came out, it was invented in three separate places about the same time, and that's basically because it's just useful. Pretend I go and observe a whole bunch of frames of somebody moving, and these are going to be motion capture frames. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to build an object that we could think about as being obtained by putting down all the frames and then stick in an edge between any frame and any frame that could go next. Sometimes there's just one edge because I saw that transition. Sometimes there's more than one edge because I saw this one and I did a little bit of computation and it said join these two as well. I might test things like derivatives and position and the like. Then when I have an object like this, if I'm willing to trust the edges, I can just say a path in this directed graph is a motion. And what I'm going to do is search this thing with constraints. So I'll say, start here, end here, do this. Let's look for a whole path. Let's look for a path with some horizon. There are a variety of methods of building the search. The thing that's important and interesting about this object is it essentially says you can compose pieces of motion that are sort of cut up and then reassembled in a way that gives you another good motion and works out fine. And as we know now, you can get wonderful... animations. This is not a particularly wonderful one, but it's one that makes a point, which is this little guy has been told to start at the top corner, going in the direction of the top arrow, and end at the bottom corner, going in the direction of the other arrow. And those are the only constraints, because it sort of seems natural to say start here and end there. And you'll notice he's got two dramatically different ways of achieving it. Typically, when we think about other people's motions, we tend to under-constrain them. So if I say, well, he started here and he went there, I didn't tell you about whether he stood there for a long time and then ran and then stood there for a long time, walked over the table, did any number of eccentric other things. So most demands, it seems to be the case that most demands that animators make are radically under-constrained. So the motion is going to be very ambiguous. At the same time, motion has this property that very often the next frame of motion is quite a lot like the one you've seen. So yes, it's ambiguous at a large scale, but at a small scale, it's quite well behaved. And that suggests that you might engage in various activities to summarize the motion in the collection and search those summaries. That can be done. Skeletons were harmed, etc. This is about 19 pieces of motion that have been reassembled, cleverly reassembled so that it looks as though they're interacting, which they're not, and rendered, and of course there we go, and it looks pretty natural. So we can do this temporal cut up and reassemble. We can't, in fact, control that motion at any real level because we said to them, start here, end there, go through this place. What we might like to do is say, run or walk or jump while you're doing this on the timeline. And it turns out that this is also something that one can achieve. So what I'm going to do now is annotate the motion with an annotation that tells me what the person is doing. And then I will write my motion demands in terms of those annotations. Right? Now, of course, the problem is, what are those annotations to be? And in fact, because we don't know what they are to be, we'll invent some. What properties do we want? Well, firstly, we should be able to compose them. So you can be running and waving, and for that matter, you might be walking and waving, or you might be walking and waving and going backwards. Now, we know that not every composition is going to work. So you're not going to be able to, for example, run and stand at the same time. Nonetheless, what we can do in a fairly straightforward way is take frames of motion capture, build one support vector machine classifier per annotation, run that over the frames, do a little bit of work with the training, and then I get a little classifier or a set of classifiers that for each frame says, this one is walking, it's not running, it's not jumping, it is standing, and it's not carrying. Well, we don't really want an annotation that looks like that because you don't want to be walking and standing at the same time, but I'm doing it to emphasize that these annotations are purely independent of each other. Now, the remarkable thing about this is these annotations can be quite accurate, which you would not necessarily expect, and they can be used. So to use them from the perspective of animation, what I could do is say, well, I got a timeline up there. Something happened to my font at the top. It doesn't really matter. I've got a timeline up there, and for the first frame, I'd like to walk and wave, but not run, jump, or carry. For the second frame, I'd like to walk, wave, not run, jump, or carry. And then for other different frames, I'd like to, for example, walk, but not wave. Now, I could rack up every frame in my motion collection over here. Now, I can compute a local charge for how well this frame's annotation matches the demand. I can draw edges between frames saying how expensive it is to go from here to here. And then I can just walk this object with dynamic programming. Now, of course, I don't really want to do that because it's too big and there's a whole bunch of ducking and weaving I'm going to have to do to actually make it work. But we won't talk about that. I put in a slide, but I'm not going to talk about it anyhow. And I get a little guy who does what he's told. And here what he's going to do is he's going to crouch, then he's going to jump, then he's going to run. He's doing some funny stuff because we're searching. Now we've found it. He's crouched, he jumped, he ran. Bingo. So we have moderate degree of control over what he does. And from the vision perspective, perhaps more important, we've been able to annotate the frames in a way that does make sense, and it palpably makes sense because we can tell this guy what to do and he does it. He's crouching, he's jumping, he's running. There are lots of other sequences, but in the interest of time, we'll skip on. So here's another property of motion where things are perhaps less positive. We know that motion composes across the body in some way. I really can walk and scratch my head. Right? So then what would you do? Well, one reasonable thing to do is cut limbs off some motions and attach them to other ones. Now, when you do that, it turns out you get some bad motions, and it's quite difficult to tell what they are. So a reasonable thing to do would be to build a classifier that can tell the good ones from the bad ones and avoid foot skate by leaving the lower body alone. Just relationships between the left arm, the right arm, and the rest of the body is enough to be working with. So sometimes this works great. Here's some rendered motion capture. Here's another piece of rendered motion capture. And you put them together and he does something different with his arms. Wonderful, right? Now what we're doing is we're getting enrichment of our collection of motion by this transplantation process. The problem is it doesn't always work. So here's another piece of motion capture rendered. Here's yet another piece of motion capture rendered. We put the two together, and it's terrible. Right? So something really bad is going on here. And what's going on is that some class of correlation across the body has been violated. The difficulty is we can't go on a fishing expedition to find out what correlations to observe, because there are too many variables. If we build a classifier, it's possible, the rest of the slide I want to ignore, but here, I can build a classifier that will tell good reconstructions from bad ones with an error rate of about 13%, and in fact, it tends not to cause problems in practice for a variety of other reasons. It turns out there are several such classifiers. There was one built here by Ren et al. Not all that long ago, and Leslie Ikemoto has built another one. The depressing thing about them is that their ROC is not good. It's a problem that doesn't seem to generalize terribly well. So about a year ago, Leslie Ikemoto was doing some stuff on blending, and she needed a classifier that would tell good blended sequences from bad ones, so she built the ensemble of HMMs and wrote out an ROC for it, and it looked, you know, it would be nice if it were better, but perhaps tolerable. And then she did something else, which was basically investigate the motion for foot skate and use that as a classifier, and it turned out to outperform the ensemble of HMMs. Now, I would not use this point to argue that foot skate is a good way of telling bad motions. I'd use the point to argue that there's quite a lot going on here that we don't understand and we should. It seems to be difficult to tell, to actually build a classifier in the standard way, to say this motion looks good and this motion looks bad. That's a technical problem we should understand, because if we did, we would understand more about composition of motion. Okay. Why would that be worthwhile? Well, we'll see in a second. So here's motion transduction. This is Deva Ramanan jumping up and down, and he's being tracked. So what I'd like to be able to do is to track people and say something about what they're doing with their bodies. There's a lot of work on this topic. You can think about people at all sorts of different scales. You can think about them as blobs, the way I did when I talked about that architectural example. You could think about them as blobs with a little bit of motion. You could think about them as motion fields, or as blobs with a little bit of motion. Or you could think about the detailed kinematics of upper arm, lower arm, upper arm, torso, legs, etc. This particular strategy has a long history, but it's never worked terribly well because it's very difficult to do. Why is it hard? Well, firstly, we know it's hard to detect people. And most of the people detectors that work well are people detectors that basically detect standing people or lateral views of walking people. It's hard to find people. Why is it hard to track them? They move fast. They can move unpredictably. We can generate large accelerations, so between frames we can move quite a lot of our body in quite unpredictable places, and some body parts are small and tend to have poor contrast. I put in these pictures, which I lifted from Deva, just to emphasize that people really can look very funny and very different indeed. This guy's throwing a ball, he's rolls his body up, swings, throws it off, and then he's beginning to look conventional again. Counting the people here is interesting. I've never actually been sure of the answer. Some facetious person said count the legs and divide by two, which doesn't help. They're mixed up by others. And here we've got two people who really do look very different from one another indeed. So the nature of the problems we need to confront are quite substantial. There are a series of strategies. One is I could build a Markov model of appearance and configuration. So I could say, well, in the first frame, the arm looked skin-colored and the upper arm looked white. And now I'm going to have a Markovian dynamics on the appearance and where these pieces are, and I'll do various forms of inference on that model. The inference gets more or less hairy depending on what you do, but the problem is it doesn't work terribly well. And one reason it doesn't work terribly well is that that Markovian model on the appearance means that if I swing my arm in front of a bookcase with a brown thing on it, I may very well leave my forearm behind. And that is a nuisance. There are other strategies to deal with this. You could use templates to encode the appearance and then dynamics on the templates. You could simply detect people in every frame. And I'm going to talk about some stuff that does that. So there are a variety of ways to build detectors, but here's one. What I would like to do is to know the color of this guy's lower legs, upper arms, lower arms, torso, and head. Now, I have a motion sequence with him moving around. He does all sorts of stuff, but as a matter of experimental fact, very often, at some point in the sequence, people just relax into a lateral walking position. Now, if I can detect the boundary of someone in this configuration, and I can detect it in such a way that I don't get many false positives. False negatives don't matter. But if I don't get many false positives, then on those detects, I can say, well, gee, there's a person here in this configuration, so that must be the color of his lower leg, that must be the color of his upper leg, that his torso, upper arm, lower arm, and head. Just read off the appearance. Once I have an appearance model, I can then go and try and match that appearance model. There's a device known as a pictorial structure model, which is able to essentially take the appearance of colors in these little boxes and say, well, gee, this matches that very well. And with a little bit of dynamic programming, find a layout. So now what we're going to do is we're going to look for the one frame where we see lateral walking. We're going to read off the appearance. Having read off the appearance, I will use a discriminative method to say, well, I know that the person is over here and the other stuff is background, so let me build something like a classifier that says, gee, these pixels really look like lower leg and not background, and these really look like torso and not background, etc. Now I build this discriminative model, and I'm going to go and run over each frame of the sequence, my torso detector, my leg detector, and my head detector. And you can see her head is being detected over here, her arms over there, and her legs over there. Now, what I will then do is sew together, let's run that again so you can see the difference between the heads, arms, legs. I think we've left out the torso in this one. Now, what I can then do is sew these together, because I can say I would like to find a configuration of patches in the image where the torso gets a strong response from the torso detector, the arms get strong responses from the arm detectors, and the legs get strong responses from the leg detectors. By doing that, we can build really quite effective trackers. They have, as I said in recent writing, some eccentricities that you have to learn to cope with, but they're not that bad. So we took these images, we found the usual pose, this lateral walking thing, we learned some limb classifiers, we marked head, leg, arm, torso, and then we took these pictorial structure models, and because we now know discriminative models of head, leg, arm, and torso, we can go and find them in any configuration. We know where she is. This tracks really rather well. So here she runs from a very bright sequence. I cannot explain the choice of video. There's a kind of a cult in Oxford of Run Lola Run, and Devaraman was affected by it when he went there. But the important bit about that sequence is she starts in the light and goes into the dark. It's a very, very difficult sequence. There's all sorts of stuff moving around in the background as well, which strongly suggests we actually can find her. We can find her at different scales. So when she gets big enough to find, we've got a reasonable idea with what she's doing of what she's doing with her body until she runs away and gets smaller, and then she disappears for our purposes. And we can track people who are doing really rather funny things with their bodies. Right? Not only that, the reports of the tracks appear to be good enough that if you look at this report of a track, you can make a fairly decent guess as to what she's doing. This report is intended to suggest covariance. So when that red blob is very red, it's really sure her torso is there, and in the sort of fainter boundaries, it's not absolutely certain that it's it could be there, but it's not as strong a probability. So you should be able to make a reasonable guess as to what this person is doing. Right? It's figure skating. And that guess, it turns out, is right. I think you can guess the gender as well, although it fails so often when I try it with audiences that I no longer have the courage. But these are sort of 5-minute sequences of figure skaters zooming around, and we've got reports of their bodies. By the way, the principle I've described, which is as you move around, the pieces of your body move around with respect to one another, but they don't change color. That principle can be used to build appearance models and track models for other things. So we'll see her zooming around later. These are the segments. So this is a report of the segments. You should notice that there are eccentricities. Occasionally it thinks her head is in a funny place, and it's not always absolutely certain where her legs are and the like. But this is a report about the body that we may very well be able to use. We can also track other things. Right? Why? Well, it's also made out of segments, and they don't change color when it moves around. And that's what you need. Okay. The next technology we're going to need is one, it's a technology that I think is actually in a slightly embarrassing state, which is lifting. I see a person in two dimensions in video, and I'd like to figure out roughly where their body is in 3D. Now, I probably can't get depth to the person, but I would like the relative depths of the bits of their body. Question, can I do that? Well, if I could, it would be extremely useful. And there are numerous papers that I say I can, up to some degree of ambiguity. And then the question that gets a bit embarrassing is that nobody's quite sure what the ambiguity is. The argument works like this. If you look at someone in an image, almost always you see them in an orthographic projection. Why? Because people don't usually hold their hand close to the camera. Typically, they're all at the same, roughly the same relative depth. If you see them in an orthographic projection, and you know roughly the size of the bits of the body, then when something looks short in the image, the reason it looks short is because it's tilted towards you or away from you. And you can estimate that angle based on your estimate of the length of the bits of the body and the scale of the camera and some other bits and pieces. So for example, from static images of someone doing something like this, Taylor showed, 7 years ago now, that if you clicked on a bunch of vertices on the body, you could immediately produce a 3D reconstruction. It's not that bad. It's rendered over here. Okay. The difficulty with this technology, which I will mention because it's kind of interesting, is there's one troubled question. It's almost certain that lifts are ambiguous, and the images I'm showing are images of a set of kinematically reachable ambiguities from a single lift. So these are four frames of a person. He would be facing the camera and holding an arm up like this. And then it could be the case that his wrist is cocked backwards or forwards. It could be the case that his forearm is forwards or backwards. And all of these configurations are in fact reachable. They're not excluded by properties of the joints. So that's some evidence that lifting is ambiguous. Now, opinions vary quite substantially about whether those ambiguities might exist, but they don't actually exist, and therefore can be ignored. So some people think they can be ignored. Others think they can be dodged by reasoning about temporal sequences. There is a summary. I wrote a summary on this point recently. I draw it to your attention because it's important, and it hasn't had the attention it needs. It looks as though you can dodge it. That's where my money has gone. If you can dodge the question, then I have a sequence of somebody moving around in 2D images. I can lift that sequence to 3D representations. I can reason about how the camera has moved in those representations, and I may be able to match. And that is the next step. So now we're going to reason about activity recognition in a variety of ways. Let's see. I'm sort of in reasonable shape with respect to time. Good. So the activity literature is plagued by this question of the fact that there isn't a specialized canonical vocabulary. So one strategy you could adopt is you could say, well, let's work in a specialized domain. Let's watch people doing Tai Chi or some other such thing, and when they do a particular move, we're going to name that move. Or they might be doing formal ballet, they do a move, we'll name the move. We could guess a vocabulary, which numerous people have used. I've blamed it on Alyosha here, but he's not the only one. I could match motions to motions and just avoid the issue of vocabulary entirely. So I could say the problem is I've got an input motion and a collection of motions. Show me which one of this collection best matches that input. And if you can answer that question, then where you put the labels over here doesn't matter all that much. And finally what I could do, is say, well, if I could synthesize with a particular vocabulary and it worked okay, then probably that's good for describing motions as well. If that hypothesis is true, I could do some activity recognition by essentially straightforward comparison to labeled data. Now, I will show you that, and then I will show you some stuff that tries to acknowledge the fact that motions are compositional across both time and the body. And finally, a discriminative method for spotting some kinds of activity in a rather specialized domain. So in the case of comparison to labeled data, I have, we already did this, I have a bunch of motion capture data, which I spent all of a minute labeling with a bunch of SVM-based annotations, which say, this frame is a walk and a wave. This frame is a stand, etc. So now what I could do is I could take my input video, track it, and we saw those tracks are noisy. Take those noisy tracks in 2D, lift them up to 3D. Right, so now I've got a sort of representation of where the body might be in 3D. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that representation, I'm going to say to the motion synthesizer, produce me a motion that is good, and we know it's good because we got it from walking a motion graph, and that produces good motions. Produce me a motion that is good and stays close to these lifted tracks. My motion synthesizer is now operating as a very complex smoothing device, if you like. So the neat thing about this is if I do that, on the other side of this picture, I spend a whole bunch of time annotating motions to control my little guy. I've got an annotated library, so I do that synthesis. And instead of doing the usual thing, which is keep the motion and chuck away the annotations, I'm going to chuck away the motion and keep the annotations. And those will describe what that person is doing. This can be made to work. And you'll notice the labels are a little bit noisy. The annotations aren't always as informative as you would like. But we've got several people running around here. We're able to label them with what they're doing. I think I've got a slow version of this movie in the next frame. Yeah, now he's moving slowly. You can see that we've got estimates in 3D that are not by no manner of means perfect. My colleague, sometime colleague Robert Walensky used to say it's bloody at the cutting edge, and this sort of applies here. They're by no manner of means perfect, but they're not outrageous. And they're enough to generate statements about what people are doing, where if you sit down and track through them in detail, you can actually keep track of who's got the ball. So we've got some statements about the body that are fairly reasonable. The problem here, of course, is our vocabulary is a bit small. It would be nice to be able to talk about things other than run, walk, carry, stand, whatever. So what could we do about that? Another example here. When he does something implausible for which we don't have labels, we can generate by this matching procedure labels that are not totally outrageous. Which is, it just says walk and wave occasionally, and it's got the right periodic structure. So we are getting some signal about what the person is doing. Okay, so now we know that, or I have claimed, I've shown some animation evidence, that activity composes across time. You can take little pieces of what people are doing, sew them together, and you still get a good activity, and sometimes at least, across the body. Now that's a useful thing, because a problem that we may face in trying to find or label activities is we may never have examples of the thing we want to find. So what I would like to be able to do is to have some kind of underlying compositional semantics that I can use to search. Secondly, I've got a moderate degree of invariance to changes of viewpoint if I reason in 3D and can get to 3D accurately. Furthermore, if I haven't got a frame of motion capture data that matches, what I might be able to do is to cut the body into four pieces, lift each quarter separately, impose the constraint that those quarters all join up, and then hope that I will not get bad motions like that because I'm lifting from people in the first place. People don't do bad motions pretty much by definition. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that motion capture data I talked about, which has labels, right? And I'm going to cut each body into four pieces, and I'm going to build short-time dynamical models for each of those short pieces based on the labels. So when you walk, you've got a little dynamical model that looks like this. When you reach, you've got a little dynamical model that looks like this. And you've got one of those for each quarter of your body for each activity. Now, the neat thing about this is I could then compose those models in an order I have never seen in data. And that will give me a labeling. I'm then going to sew these models together to get a composite dynamical model. So I'll say basically, here is the dynamical model for waving the left arm. As long as it ends up in a state that is not too far away from reaching with the left arm, you can then transition from waving to reaching. And we'll do this in a very superficial fashion, just looking at how similar things are. Now, what I have now is basically a whacking great HMM that takes into account composition across quarters of the body, has been trained on motion capture data that was labeled. So I don't have to worry about inferring the states or learning the states or anything like that. I built the state machine. And inference is quite straightforward. So what I'm going to do is say, given a motion sequence, can I answer the following question? What is, for example, the probability that the leg is walking, the arm is walking, then the leg walks and the arm reaches, given the sequence? And I can compute that probability in a straightforward way. So what we did was we went out and collected, Nazlia Kisler and I, went out and collected a whole bunch of motions of people against relatively simple backgrounds. This is a question about how the activity is constructed, not what's the best way to get the person off the background, which is another important topic. And we got them to do large numbers of different things. Then we said, let's take this collection, author a search, and by author a search, I mean literally write down a search that says, I want to see a wave and then a carry. And then based on that authored search with no motion examples, rank all of the motions in that collection and ask a person to say which responses actually are good responses to that query. So I'm showing results. This is quite a full figure. I'm showing results for a lot of different queries over here. We have about 70 motion sequences. Ignore the color keys for a second. I'll explain them in a second. But up there, where it says walk carry, what I mean is the little colored blocks mean that sequence was, in fact, a walk carry sequence. Walk carry, in its column, ranks all of the sequences according to the likelihood, P of walk carry condition on the data. Then run carry re-ranks them. And we're asking, what we'd really like is to have all of the little colored blocks over here. Because that would mean the ones that were right were ranked high. Okay. Now, I'm sorry, all my travails are beginning to exhaust me. If you look at this, firstly, the picture you see is, well, yeah, they're pretty much at this end. It's not perfection by any manner of means, but they're pretty much at this end. Secondly, clothing doesn't matter. Why? Because the green ones are people clothed one way. The red ones are different clothing. The yellow are a different set of clothing, and the blue are yet another set of clothing. One needs to check these things. So rather generally, you get the answer about right. You get the answer about right for sequences that are really quite complex. Walk, stand, wave, walk. And the clothing doesn't affect. Okay. Furthermore, the aspect doesn't affect it either. So what I'm plotting here is mean average precision for different angles of view as the camera moves around the body for queries for jog, jump, jump, jack, reach, and wave. So basically looking at someone at 0 degrees, 45 degrees, 90, 135, 180, etc., really doesn't much affect the precision of the queries. So my query doesn't mind changes of aspect. I'm sorry,
was
question.
Was zero defined in some meaningful way? So
let's see. The two questions here. Was zero defined in a meaningful way? I'm sure. What way do I remember? I think the issue is that zero is front. I think zero is frontal, and round here is lateral, right? And I think for a bunch of these motions, you reveal more about what you're doing when you're seen from the side than from when you're seen in front. But I would have to actually check in the written version of it. I got 4 hours kip last night as a result of some trouble at Chicago, and I just can't get my hands on the details. But there are different aspects of the body reveal more or less about what you're doing. This is absolutely clear. And you would expect some pattern here. I'm not sure if this is necessarily the pattern to expect, but you'd expect some pattern here. Okay. A question.
Why do you say, looking at this graph, that it doesn't seem to matter? I mean, I see a 30% difference between 20%.
Because why don't we wait a couple more slides, and I'll show you how catastrophically it can matter if you don't take account of it. That's probably the right way to answer. Okay. So the last thing I'm going to talk about is an attempt to deal with some of these sort of broader issues in fact, a very narrow frame. So a good, interesting topic of study, if one's interested in activity, is American Sign Language. It's a language that's rendered by motions of the hands, the head, the face, and the body. As we can see here, different words are produced in different ways by different signers under different circumstances. So what I've shown up here is an avatar from an animated dictionary producing the word book. They move as though they've been animated. Well, they're moving under the effect of very slow hydraulics. So she does this, and her hands go back. Very unnatural motion. This is one of our subject signers, and she's making the word book. You'll notice that she's holding her hands quite high on her body and quite far apart. In a later sequence, she holds them about as high on her body, but close together. So there's variation in the way people produce signs. Now, what we'd like to do is to spot words in sequences of American Sign Language. It's a natural and reasonable thing to want to do, and you'd sort of expect to be able to do it. The thing that one would want to do is rack up an HMM, use a phonological dictionary of sign language, tie the phonemes together, do the usual thing, and think about it as a speech problem. That doesn't work terribly well because the phonological dictionaries aren't there. So a natural thing you might do is to say, let's just do word spotting. I'm going to build one classifier per word, and I'm going to go and find the words one after the other. Now, if I'm going to do that, my classifier has to be a bit special. I don't want the classifier to care who the person is, and I don't want the classifier to care what the aspect is, and I want to be able to train the classifier on maybe one example or a few examples out of the animated dictionary and send it out into the world to proceed. It turns out that one can do this. So what are we going to do? Well, and we'll get to your point. I haven't forgotten. What are we going to do? I'm going to go to this dictionary, and for some set of words, the examples over here are basketball, appreciate, angry, whatever, I will get sequences from my dictionary, and I will also get sequences from my new signer, and my new signer at my new aspect. So I know what she looks like when she says basketball, and I know what she looks like when she says basketball, and I know what she looks like when she says basketball. Now, what I want to be able to do is look at her, say daughter, and then build a classifier up there, and then just drop it on this video and have it work. So what am I going to do? Absolute descriptions of what people look like are not very helpful under these circumstances because the person has changed aspect, the person's gotten bigger, it's moving differently, that sort of thing. But relative descriptions might be helpful. So if when she makes the word basketball, part of the word daughter also looks a lot like basketball, we can expect that when she makes the word basketball, part of the word daughter also looks a lot like the word basketball. And I can build a collection of features that instead of making absolute statements about what the body looks like, make relative statements. This piece of this word looks a lot like this piece of that word and very little like this piece of that word. That kind of feature is going to transfer. Now let me skip that strategy slide and we'll get to sort of the end. What do I have here? This is a class confusion matrix. In the class confusion matrix, I am reporting the results for a search with a single word classifier for different target words over a sequence containing 70 words. That single word classifier has been trained on a frontal view of the avatar and has not seen a frontal view of the real person. These are the shared words, the basketball, etc. These are the target words, like the daughter. You will notice that when we ask to find a target word, most of the time we get it. In fact, if you sit down and compute the error rate, it's about 30%. For your question, let's go one more slide and I'll answer your question. This is what happens when you change aspects. Again, I have never seen this word, the word I am searching for, produced in three-quarter view by a real person. I've seen it produced frontally by an avatar. Now I'm going to go and look. Again, basically, I find it. I make mistakes, but you know, life is never perfect. I find it. What happens if I build a classifier that is not relative in its construction, doesn't use this feature construction, but just basically takes an absolute representation of the image and compares to three quarters? It's a version of your question. The answer is the error rate goes from being about 30% to being about 99%. I mean, you just get everything wrong, right? And the reason you get everything wrong is that people look really different in a three-quarter view than in a frontal view, and this absolute description just doesn't work. Okay, so we've been through an awful lot of stuff. Several conclusions. These tend to be a bit wet, largely because this whole question of what people are doing, how to think about what people are doing, is open ground. Synthesizing motion is hard. I've shown you a bunch of example-based methods that are a very small sampling of a big pool of example-based methods that work quite well. It's not obvious that they should work well, and it's pleasing that they do. There is a big game afoot here, which is it would be really nice to generate more motions from the same amount of or less data without quality going down. It's reasonable to believe that statistics would be helpful because that's the nature of statistics, but currently, you know, the jury is out, I think. Composition across the body is very hard indeed, and it's depressingly hard. It means we don't understand something we should understand. Second big point, transducing motion is really hard. It would be nice to have representational machinery that said, you know, is this like a motion? What name attaches to motion this is like? And we don't really have that. What should we be worrying about? How should motion be represented? How should it be described? And the kind of iceberg in this talk, which is very few motions occur innocent of nearby objects. Usually when I'm doing something to something, or with something, or near something, and the interpretation of my motion depends on what that thing is. This question has largely not been explored, and it's got interesting things in it, in my opinion. Okay, so again, showing some thanks. I also can't resist showing Ryan White's rear end. He's bouncing up and down in some cloth. When he bounces up and down in some cloth, we can reconstruct the cloth. The neat thing about this is, here's another measurement that is revealing about the body. What clothing around the body does as you move around. It tells something about your motion, it tells something about your body, and most of the things it tells us, we don't know. Let's talk about him below the knees. You can make quite good estimates of what his gastrocnemius muscle looks like, by the way, from just looking at that sequence. This is our skater doing her stuff, and we can watch it while I answer the very few questions I'm allowed before I run and jump in a taxi, I guess.
Oh, right. Well, let's thank David. I should mention that David did spend last night visiting all the airports in the Midwest area and just gotten here. We had a panic because he wasn't at the hotel, but it turns out that he was in different airports all night, and he has done marvelously well. So please, questions for David.
So there's a question.
Talking about the vocabulary and emotions most papers that I see have maybe between 3 and 10 different emotions that they try to recognize in imagery. And I was wondering if you could speak to the idea of, well, how many semantically different emotions do you think would represent, let's say, 95% of what people do? And
Wow. Okay.
So just, I mean, I know you can quibble about what do you mean by semantically different, but you know, like, what is the ballpark sort of size of a vocabulary which we eventually need in order to be able to recognize all motions and then, or classify all motions, and then what do we need to achieve to get from where we are now, 3 to 10, to wherever that is?
So I think that I wish I could give you an intelligent answer to that question. Basically, I can speculate a bit. So, firstly, there's a depressing thing about frequency here that we have to be careful about. Pretty much, you could explain about 95% of any motion video you see by understanding walking and ignoring everything else. Why? Because that's the vast majority of what people do. If they're not walking, they're sitting. Okay. So, the sort of usual reasoning one has about frequency, which is, you know, if it works for 95% of my data set, I'm okay. It begins to become a bit unstuck. It's not those common ones that we care about. It's probably something else. So the first thing that gets difficult here is we really do need to think about what we mean by success and frequency. I don't know the answer. I think it depends very delicately on your views about composition. You could take the position that almost everything is different, and that each of those different things have a small number of parameters, and you just have to know about a very large number of different things. And a not unreasonable interpretation of those failed transplantation examples, which I can show you by the hundred, by the way, there really is a problem there, is that that really is the way motion is represented in the human motor system, and we just have to deal with it. I don't think that's right, because it seems a bit messy and implausible. An alternative view is that people have motions they're good at, and then sort of cut them up and join them to other ones. And if one understood the process of cutting and joining better, then the vocabulary would be small. Could I speculate on what the size was? Absolutely not. I think a better line of attack is to think about what the mechanism is that generates complexity of motions, as opposed to how many there are. Right? But I'm placing a bet. There's no received truth that I can make available. It may be the case that you could classify an awful lot of motions without knowing very much about what you're doing.
Chris?
So I couldn't tell you, Doc, how much of these representations were called an image or view-based and how much were 3D. And I suspect they were mostly flat image-based kinds of representations.
No, I'm a swinger. I have no opinion about the distinction between 3D and 2D representations, and I'll use either one.
So the ASL, for example, did you try to figure out 3D passing?
No. So that one was done deliberately 2D because there's been a lot of work on detailed studies of aspectual changes in hands in rendering ASL, and it tends to be quite difficult to use. Right? So what the hypothesis we were after, and we think we've got it, is very often things that you might think are subtly different are actually different in a big way. Now, there's some evidence that that's not just total good luck, right? So one of the kind of secrets of motion capture data is you can usually cluster it, and it works fine, right? And that's mildly surprising. Motion capture data tends to be the stuff that people cluster. They're clustering kind of 300-dimensional signals, which, you know, you could expect things to go wrong under those circumstances, and they don't. And that would suggest that at least for some collections of motion under some circumstances, etc., things are actually quite different on a big scale rather than on a small scale. And that's what we're going for in the ASL. But I have no opinion about the distinction between 2D and 3D representations. In all honesty, I think it's a non-issue. If you can go from one to the other reasonably fluidly, you just use what you've got and leave it at that.
Any other questions?
Sounds like we're done.
All right.
Thank you
very much. Thank you, speaker.
Sorry.